This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 5th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and we'll hear from CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Preschool and child care, they're expensive, and finding an opening that works for your family can be difficult. Those concerns were in focus on Cape Cod this week as Governor Maura Healey visited the Cape to announce that seven new school districts are joining a state grant program to expand preschool access. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with this story and more. Hiya, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, you went out to the Cape Cod YMCA in Barnstable, where Governor Healey made this announcement. Tell us who's joining the state program and what it involves.
Sure. Barnstable and Wareham are the local towns to us that are new to the program. And these grants are designed to help communities offer more preschool seats that are both affordable and high in quality, generally by adding teachers and adding classrooms to the existing preschool providers in the community. Those could be public schools, they could be organizations like the YMCA, Head Start, and similar programs. Nine school districts have been part of this in the past, including Sandwich. Sandwich is already a member. And those current communities as a group are getting a new round of money right now, enough to add 488 seats altogether, so an average of 54 per district. And now Barnstable and Wareham are among seven new districts that the state is bringing into the program. So that's what the governor was announcing on Wednesday here at the Cape YMCA. It's both a new round of grant money and new districts being added.
What do we know about how Barnstable and the other communities joining this program will use the money? Are they adding new preschool seats as well?
I asked the Barnstable School Superintendent Sarah Ahern about that. She was at the YMCA on Wednesday. She said Barnstable right now is getting a planning grant. So these new seats are not available quite yet. First, they have to do the planning, but they have a pretty tight timeline. They want to get this done by August. And she said a team of people from the Barnstable School District will be discussing it with other providers in the community to figure out what is the best way to serve more children of preschool age? How many seats could they add? And then the goal would be to get a follow-up grant to actually implement an expanded preschool plan, but they would be on track and eligible for that grant if they follow the necessary planning steps here. So this is just the beginning, but it also offers a chance for providers in the community to get involved kind of on the ground floor in designing what this expansion would look like.
Governor Healey here says that she's concentrating these efforts in gateway cities and rural communities for now. What's that mean? What's the definition of a gateway city?
Sure. So the term gateway city refers to the idea that frequently these are cities that historically were gateways to opportunity for people to looking to build a life in America, sometimes immigrants, sometimes not, but they had stable jobs, often in manufacturing. After the manufacturing jobs left in large numbers, those communities really needed some support to create new opportunities. And Massachusetts originally had a smaller number of cities that they designated as gateway cities. They were mostly the bigger cities that are not Boston. So places like Worcester, Springfield, it also included New Bedford, Fall River, Brockton, and others. But since then, a formal definition has been written into state law, and more communities are included. So the definition is based on your population size, income in the community, and educational attainment. So Barnstable is now included in the group of gateway cities, but not all of the towns in this preschool program are gateway cities. Yeah.
Let's turn to offshore wind now. There were a couple of wind stories in the news this week that will affect our region. One is a commission appointed by Governor Healey that's recommending changes in how renewable energy projects get approved for construction. Tell us about this.
Yes, Healey's goal with this commission is to speed up the approval of renewable energy projects which of course would help the state meet its climate goals. So she appointed this group to make recommendations on how to accelerate the permitting for those projects, which right now the permitting has no deadline and can take years. These, of course, are things like solar and onshore components of offshore wind, plus related equipment like transmission lines, substations, and so on. And the commission's recommendations came out this week. With the exception of very small projects, the commission is saying that the state should consolidate state and local permitting for these renewable energy projects into one process that is led by the Energy Facilities Siting Board. That's a state body. So it would change the way communities interact with the permitting process now. Towns would be invited to participate in this state process early on and to propose conditions that might be placed on the state permit. But there has been considerable discussion about whether these changes would reduce local control over projects, especially when it comes to things that have drawn some opposition on the Cape, such as the onshore facilities for offshore wind farms.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. We've seen how local input on these kinds of proposed projects can feel like a big deal, especially as conversations around cables coming ashore have happened in communities here on the Cape. Would local control over these projects actually change with this proposed
Well,
change in the process?
yes, that is an interesting question. So the Healey administration official who briefed reporters this week about the recommendations from this commission says that the true jurisdiction over energy siting would actually stay the same because the state already has that jurisdiction. That is because renewable energy developers who have been denied in their local community or what's called unduly delayed by a town board can already go directly to the state for a certificate that essentially sidesteps that local denial. So people in the community, especially those who are not happy about the offshore wind cables landing on the beaches in Barnstable, are saying that this represents a further stripping of the town from the town of local control. But when I talked to the Barnstable town manager, Mark Ells, his reaction was like, "What local control?" You know, he's frustrated that people keep coming to him and asking him why the town is allowing all of this power infrastructure, when he says the town really has no choice because, again, the state is allowing it. Developers can go directly to the state. He says that the local permitting rule for these energy infrastructure projects really is very limited, involves some easements, he said, and conservation commission work, but he said it's really not much.
How about the host community agreements, Vineyard Wind and Avangrid? They're paying Barnstable tens of millions of dollars. But now, if the developers are not going, if they're going straight to the state, will they be motivated to provide these benefits to those communities that they have to pass through?
That is a good question. Yes, as well. So the Healey administration says these recommendations still strongly encourage developers to sign host community agreements. They say having local buy-in is certainly something that the state would be considering in the permitting, but having a host community agreement would not be required. When it comes to offshore wind, some of the economic benefits for communities do come through the bidding process, right? So the state can select bidders for contracts that offer the most benefits. But those economic benefits from the bid process are typically kind of wide lens things like bringing jobs to your region, whereas host community agreements offer more specific town-based payments that could do something like sewering work, for example. So towns are still really going to be pushing for those agreements.
And right now, these are just recommendations. Is that right? What happens with this?
That's right. So the status of this is that it is just a set of recommendations, but Governor Healey is likely to put many of those recommendations into a legislative proposal. That was the purpose behind this commission. So, whether she will include everything remains to be seen. And then, to actually become law, these changes would need to be passed by the legislature and then, of course, signed by the governor.
Okay, in another offshore wind story you reported this week, two offshore wind projects adjacent to Vineyard Wind received a major federal approval. This is not technically the last thing they need from the federal government, but it's the most significant step in this approval process. Explain this part for us.
Yes, this is a decision in favor of two projects. Until recently, they've been called Park City Wind and Commonwealth Wind. They are owned by Avangrid, which has renamed them New England Wind 1 and 2. And you're right, this document they've received is not absolutely the final step for their federal approvals, but the Biden administration announces these as if they are the moment of approval, because that is essentially what they are. This document is called a Record of Decision, and it represents the approval of multiple federal agencies that have been part of the environmental review of the project over a couple of years. So New England Wind 1 and 2 now have this document in hand. They still need a document from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management that approves their construction and operations plan, plus some EPA permits. Avangrid told me they still need, but this really is the moment when it is considered that, yes, you have the okay from the federal government.
Okay, with all these different companies and their different names for their different wind constructions, it's hard to keep track of them. Remind us where these wind farms would be and where they're planning to bring this power ashore.
Yes, so these two that got this big federal approval this week would be starting about 23 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. If listeners have seen that map of wind areas that shows the wind areas as kind of these diagonal stripes out in the ocean, these two are in the same stripe as Vineyard Wind, directly to the southwest of Vineyard Wind. They're again in New England Wind 1 and 2. They are approved for up to 129 turbines combined. It looks like there actually may be some flexibility in the size of each project, because if you look at the maximum number for project one and the maximum number for project two, they add up to more than 129. But the document they have that's called the Record of Decision clearly says the combined number is 129. It says also that those turbines could power up to 900,000 homes. But it is interesting to see that in order to get that much power with this number of turbines, they will need higher capacity turbines than the ones used for Vineyard Wind. So Vineyard Wind had 13 megawatt turbines that were later rated higher for at 13.6. And the federal government in their documents now says these new projects would need to have turbines more like 16 megawatts to meet those power production goals.
And Avangrid, they must be especially happy to get this approval now because they're trying to get a state contract for these projects. So just having the location approved doesn't mean that they're ready to go. They need the power contract to go forward.
Yes, they are certainly happy, and they say these projects are what they call mature, meaning far along in the approval process. The Avangrid says that the first phase, New England Wind 1, would actually be about 5 years ahead of where any new project would be if it started today. And they have certainly emphasized that sort of shovel-ready status as a strength in their bid. They are bidding in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island right now for contracts to sell the power. And two other companies are also bidding in Massachusetts, South Coast Wind and Vineyard Offshore. So we will see how that goes. It will be at least August before the state announces a winner or winners of those next contracts.
Okay, let's get to the really big story, the solar eclipse coming on
Right.
Monday. Of course, we've been hearing a lot about that in the national media as well, but I want to get to some reporting you did. You got a chance to sit down with a member of the Wareham High School Astronomy Club and the teacher who serves as the advisor for that club. Tell us, what are they doing getting ready for the eclipse?
A lot, actually. So Wareham High School has both the astronomy club and a class in astronomy. Alfonso Navarro is a science teacher in physics and astronomy at Wareham High, and he's the advisor for the club. He says that in class they have done solar observation, that is, looking at the sun safely with eclipse glasses in the middle of the day to see how that works, how it's done. They've talked about how to use those glasses to protect your vision. They've actually tested the glasses for safety, and he recommends that you should do this test yourself, which is put the glasses on and shine a bright flashlight or even your phone light into your eyes through the glasses. You should see only the very teeny teeniest amount of light, and that lets you make sure there aren't any scratches or pinholes or anything that could let the light shine through. I also met Emma McWilliams, who is a junior at Wareham High School and a member of the astronomy club. She says that they have learned how to make a pinhole viewer. So folks have probably heard quite a bit about this, but it can be very simple to make one. It allows you to view the shape of the sun during the eclipse by letting the light pass through a small hole onto a viewing surface, like a piece of paper. And the hole really can be cut in almost anything, like paper, foil, or it can even be a colander, they said. So if you use a colander, you'll see many tiny eclipse shapes all in a pattern on the on your surface, which is pretty cool. And that's a safe way to view the eclipse. And then, in addition to all of that, Mr. Navarro also did a talk at the library about the eclipse. And the astronomy club has astronomy nights at Wareham High almost monthly on the softball field, where they look at the night sky, and students can invite their friends and parents to that as well. So they've had a lot going on in Wareham.
All right, so this is happening Monday in the afternoon. I think it gets going around 2:30, and it takes a while for it to happen, obviously. Tell us what they're planning to do on Monday during that eclipse.
Yes, so the peak time here is around 3:30 in the afternoon. School will be out by then. So Emma says she's planning to view the eclipse with her mom in town, outside their house, and her mother loves astronomy, so that's one thing that makes it exciting for her. Navarro, the teacher, is traveling into the path of totality, actually, up in the Adirondacks in New York. He says he's from there originally, so that's his plan, to head up to New York. And he has never seen the corona in person. Remember, that is the outer part of the sun's atmosphere that can only be seen with the naked eye at totality, during a total solar eclipse. So I hope he gets to see that. But something Emma brought up that I hadn't really appreciated, I think, until I talked to them, is that if you look at a map, we really are pretty close to the line of 90% totality. So, people are saying, oh, we're far from it, but certainly we won't see a total eclipse here, but it will be almost 90% and still a very cool viewing experience, I think.
Yeah, and it's all weather dependent. Just checking the weather map right now, looking like Monday here on Cape Cod. Sunshine in the forecast, so we should be able to see it. That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Edgartown School has had a turbulent year as numbers of parents have come forward with issues and concerns over how the school's being run and its priorities. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with an update that includes some big changes in school leadership there. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
So the news here is that both the principal and the assistant principal are leaving. The principal's retiring. The assistant principal is resigning. What do we know about these changes?
Yeah, this is the principal. This is after 5 years that she's been with the school. That kind of was announced this week. And right, it comes just kind of 2 weeks after, 2 or 3 weeks after the assistant principal announced that she would be stepping down or resigning as well. But right, we can't say for certain exactly why they are stepping down or retiring. But it does, follow what, as you were saying, kind of turbulent few months. There was this big school committee meeting where something like 200 parents attended, and there were some serious accusations made. We also got our hands on a letter that was submitted to the school administration with a lot of complaints from anonymous parents. Basically that some were saying that student needs weren't being met. You have a lot of English as second language students there in the district, a lot of high needs students, and some parents were telling us that maybe some of the more high functioning students, their needs were not being challenged enough. And school committee members were also raising concerns that the school was losing students to school choice. Now, again, we didn't get comment from the administration about the top two administrators stepping down, at least in time for our story. And we can't definitively say why they are, but we thought fair to point to this recent past as kind of a backdrop for these decisions. In her retirement letter, that the principal said that, you know, she's proud of some of the things that she's been able to accomplish in her tenure, like navigating, you know, the school through the pandemic, you know, no small feat, hiring 11 new positions. And Steve, if you want to get into this a little, she did mention the work on an island-wide kind of equity audit that we've been really interested in.
So tell us a little bit about this equity audit. It's an attempt to kind of dive down into what's happening in the school and how it's allocating resources.
Yeah, it's actually for the whole kind of all island schools, but it's done through surveys and parents and students, I believe, others in the school community as well. There's all kinds of committees that are involved for each of the schools on the island. But our understanding is that the audit will look at kind of fairness of policies and programming as it relates to staff, and that's relative to race, ethnicity, gender, to see where there might be gaps in education, what the schools can do to improve, and it's being done with the help of kind of a national nonprofit. But the island-wide district has been working on this since the fall, but it was sort of announced publicly in the fall out of these kind of contentious Eggertown meetings and complaints this winter. Report the results aren't expected until the summer, and we're looking forward to seeing those. But an interesting wrinkle, though, there was a discussion this past week of how the results would be released to the public. It's ultimately up to the administration, but some school committee members are pushing for its release. So more to come there.
One can imagine people would want to see those results, that they would be there would be some energy from the public to have those made as public as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's to be seen. It's not like anyone in the administration saying, no, we're not going to release this. It's kind of more, this is the process. They go through this audit, and then it's given to the superintendent and the administration, and then they can decide where it goes from there. But school committee members really at this meeting we covered are saying, you know, there's been a lot of interest in this, and it should really be released to the public, and we've gotten a lot of comments on our story saying essentially the same thing.
We're going to have to leave it there. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, where you can read all about it. Sam, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Support public radio.
All right, somebody who's been listening to the fun drive there, I can tell. Let's move on. Chatham's Harbor Master since 1999. That's right, since the previous century, is retiring. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with this story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, we're talking about Stuart Smith. I think many of us in the news business have been fortunate to be able to call up Stuart Smith at times over the years, usually times of terrible weather when we wanted to know what was happening in Chatham Harbor. Tell us about this change there in Chatham.
Yeah, well, Stu's certainly always been accessible to not only people like us in the media, but the public, and that was one of the strengths that was cited when there was sort of a change of watch ceremony last week when Stu officially retired and his successor, Jason Holm, who was the assistant harbor master, was elevated to the position of harbor master. You know, everybody sees Stuart Smith as sort of one of the last of the old guard of Chatham's town officials. He was, as you said, Steve, he was in the office since 1999, but he was working for the town for 14 years before that, most significantly as wharfinger. So he's been a fixture on the town's waterfront for several decades. And he'll be missed because he really had a handle on how things work here. He had a good working relationship with both town residents and fishermen and others who frequent the waterfront. And he just had a really good manner about him, and willing to talk to people and to really do what was needed to make things happen. Jason Holm is sort of following in Stu's footsteps. He's a former Coast Guard officer. He was a surfman and in charge of Chatham Station for a number of years. So he really knows the area, and he's been schooled in how to work the harbor master position with Stu. So, you know, there's a lot of confidence that there's going to be basically no disruption in how the town's waterfront operates with this really significant change.
I want to talk about another end of an era story in the paper this week over at the Eldridge Library. A tree more than 100 years old came down. It was taken down.
Yeah, it was taken down by the town. This is a about 120 year old, but nobody's quite sure how old it is. Horse chestnut tree on the corner of Main Street and Library Lane, in front of the Elders Library. The problem, the tree was okay. It wasn't ill, sick or anything like that. The problem was that the library is developing a new landscaping plan that's necessary to make the facility accessible. And in order to do that, the sidewalk out front needs to be redone, and doing so will cut into the roots of this tree. And doing so will basically probably weaken it and most likely would eventually kill it. And for safety reasons, town officials didn't want to take a chance of having this tree weakened and having the chance of branches or limbs falling down. So it was decided, after a lot of agonizing, this has gone on for a couple of years now, to take this tree down, basically. So they did that last Wednesday, and a number of the excuse me, pieces of the tree were salvaged by some local woodworkers, and the Chatham Friends of Trees group were able to secure basically the main trunk of this tree, which was 110 inches in diameter. So it's a pretty big tree. And the Friends of Trees are going to take that wood, and they haven't decided what they're going to do with it. There's ideas about maybe turning it into benches or other useful items. One of the ideas that I particularly thought was kind of cool was to take a cross section of that tree and laminate it and be able to count the rings and mark the different events in Chatham history that occurred while that tree was there, and be able to mount that somewhere in public. I thought that that's one of the things they're working on. I thought that was kind of cool.
Big change there in front of the Eldridge Library. It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Large vessels in Cape Cod Bay may have to abide by new speed limits being proposed by fisheries managers in order to reduce the risk of ship strikes to endangered right whales. William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain how that could impact the town's economy. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you doing today? Thanks for having me.
So well. Thank you for joining us. I wanted to ask you first to explain the proposed new rules for us so that we can understand what's being proposed here.
Definitely. So there are already vessel speed rules in place that have been in place since 2008. And they restrict vessels that are 65 feet or longer from going over 10 knots per hour within specific zones at certain times of year. In Cape Cod Bay, that's January 1st to May 15th, and then off Race Point, that's March 1st to April 15th. And this new regulation would alter a few things. It would crucially expand the types of vessels that qualify for the 10 knot speed limit down to 35 feet. It would also establish much larger restrictive areas that would span from northern Massachusetts to northern North Carolina, the entire coast, and would last from November 1st to May 30th.
I think many people think of the islands as being dependent on ferry service, which they are, and this rule would affect mm-hmm. them too. But Provincetown has a seasonal ferry service linking it to Boston, and this could really be impacted here, even though right now they're kind of the dates people are really looking at are extending it into March or April, but there's other ways this could really impact that ferry service. Is that right?
That's right. Currently, it would alter the ferry service so that we would lose 2 weeks at the end of May from those fast ferries that go to and from Provincetown. And I should emphasize, technically, the ferries wouldn't be banned from going through this area. They would just have to go at 10 knots per hour, which, according to Michael Glasfeld, who's one of the ferry operators I spoke to, would turn a 90-minute ferry ride into a 4.5-hour ferry ride. So at best, they'd be able to operate one round trip a day, and at worst, they might not be able to operate at all.
And then there's also part of the rules may put that 10-mile-an-hour speed limit into effect if whales show up in Cape Cod Bay during the summer. So there's a potential for this impacting summer ferry traffic as well.
Yes, this is the other element of it that's a little bit more controversial, I would say. I should say this whole rule is something that is just in its proposal stage. It The draft we're working with was in September 2022, and they're still working through what exactly will be in the final rule. But yes, there's this additional element called dynamically managed areas. And these areas would pop up. They're 400 square nautical miles. And if there is an aggregation of at least three right whales in the bay, it would cause one of these areas to pop up that would be a 10-knot speed limit zone. And I should stress that this isn't something that's really happened before, with one crucial exception. I spoke with Stormy Mayo at the Center for Coastal Studies, and he explained that there was one summer in the 1980s when there was an aggregation of right whales in Cape Cod Bay. And had this rule that is in this proposal stage been in place, it might have created that 10-knot zone in Cape Cod Bay for much of the summer.
Mm. I want to return to where I kind of set this up with, which is talking about the economic impact on the town for the ferries and for what happens if they have to cut back service as maybe sort of an effect of these rules.
Yeah, so one element, of course, is the impact on the ferries themselves. Michael Glassell, who I spoke to, argued that this would end up costing him the 2-week extension of the vessel speed limit would end up costing him about half of his company's profits. But the other impact, of course, is that those are 2 weeks in which ferry visitors aren't going to be visiting Provincetown. And according to a letter written by the town manager back in 2022, the average person who visits Provincetown for the day will often spend as much as $450 in town. And if they're staying for the week, it's $6,500. So you can imagine that those ferry visitors not being there could impact the town's overall economy.
Mm. And then if these there's another number there that I know that Representative Bill Keating was talking about that's much higher.
Yes. And this is what the number he's referring to, I believe, was around $100 million.
Mm-hmm.
That number would be if the ferry service was shut down altogether. Now, again, I should say that the odds of that happening seem pretty low based on how often right whales show up in Cape Cod Bay in the summer. But if something were to change about their foraging patterns, and if what the ferry operators have spoken to are correct about how that would impact their overall business, that is a possibility, although admittedly a remote one.
Hmm. It's William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent, where you can find the story. William, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. The Nantucket fishing community is taking stock now that commercial scallop season has ended. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with an update on this story and more. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Optimism and concern, those are the two words in the headline for this story. Explain how they go together.
A little bit of both. There are definitely signs of optimism that the fishery, the scallop fishery on Nantucket, which has really been decimated over the last 20 or so years due to a declining eelgrass population, which provides the habitat for bay scallops, has really been on the decline. But it appears to be coming back to some degree, some of the scientists and fishermen say. The total number of scallops harvested this year was easily above the last several seasons' numbers, about 8,700 bushels, with a few final tallies still outstanding. Last season's total was 7,200 bushels, and it's been as low as the mid-3,000s over the last couple of years as well. And the handful of fishermen who went out until the end of March, the end of the season, were still pretty much coming in with their full 5-bushel limit every day. But unfortunately, it isn't the pure number of scallops that typically have fishermen pulling their boats in the late winter and early spring, but their ability to get a good price for the scallops. The fish market owners said that demand on the customer side tends to decline as the season goes along. It's the highest around the holidays and then drops off after the new year. And that generally means lower prices to fishermen. This year actually is pretty good, though. Fishermen were still getting $20 to $22 a pound for their scallops all the way through the season. But that doesn't always happen. Last season, the price dropped as low as $15 a pound. Sort of coupling with the decline in price on the island, off-island distributors in recent years have had less interest in buying bay scallops from Nantucket fishermen, just given the general industry's decline in the last decade or so and their inability to provide the scallops that the distributors need. So all of that, obviously manifests itself in the scalloper's bottom line. But if there's any real positive coming out of this, it's that the health of the harbor seems to be improving. Mm. The scallops are there. Now it's just a matter of the fishermen and the distributors and the fish markets all getting together and reminding everybody that Nantucket Bay scallops are out there and they're plentiful.
Hey, Josh, let's talk about short-term rentals. Town meeting in May will once again be taking up articles around how the town deals with them. We just had a big lawsuit, a judge passing a judgment on this. But bring us up to speed. What are we looking at?
We're looking at continued complexity, continued debate over short-term rentals. At the May 7th town meeting, there will be at least one article where voters will be asked to approve short-term rentals across the island in any and all residential districts as primary uses. That is also comes in, will follow the recent land court case, which determined that short-term rentals are not primary uses. And resulting from that was two new short-term rental proposals that are being considered for future special town meetings. They will not be in the town meeting coming up on May 7th. The select board determined this week that would be too difficult to add them into a special town meeting within the town meeting, but a separate meeting could be held after that. Both of these articles, which would define the allowed use of short-term rentals in residential areas, would, if passed, render the land court decision moot because they would remove the ambiguity from the town zoning code about what a short-term rental is. One of them seeks to tie the number of primary-use short-term rentals to the town's subsidized housing inventory while offering a 10-year grace period for corporate and multiple ownership and permanent exemption for current owners who only have one STR. And the second is very comparable to an initiative that was defeated at the 2023 town meeting, which would require that homes be lived in by their owners or rented long-term for more than they are used to short-term rentals. So a lot still to be debated, a lot still going on. This doesn't look like it's going to be decided anytime soon.
Well, I was going to say, so there's this one article that's appearing in the May town meeting, but then these two other ones are still hanging out there. So people are supposed to vote in the May town meeting on one, knowing that there's two more still sitting out there for a special town meeting.
That they could be brought up potentially at a special town meeting. The proponent of one of the articles says she already has the 200 signatures required to initiate a special town meeting. And depending on what happens at the May 7th town meeting, I think it's pretty fair to say that she will call that special town meeting.
All right. We'll be talking about it. That is Josh Bolling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
After nearly 10 years of a legal fight, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe is celebrating a major victory this week. CAI's Eve Zukoff has details on how the tribe finally won access to its lands in trust. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This legal battle the tribe fought made its way to the Supreme Court. Walk us through what they said this week.
Sure. The U.S. Supreme Court said that they would be refusing to hear an appeal by a small group of Taunton residents who sought to reverse a lower court's ruling to keep two parcels of tribal lands in trust for the tribe. The tribe points out that the land is less than 1% of their original homelands, but this is something. It's 321 acres of reservation land across Taunton and Mashpee.
Right. So this is the final ruling of a case that was originally brought in 2015. Take us through some of the evolution of that case. It's gone back and forth a lot.
Yeah, pretty convoluted case. So in 2015, the Department of Interior under the Obama administration put the land into trust for the tribe. Then this group of about two dozen Taunton residents challenged the move, saying that the tribe didn't fall under the federal government's definition of Indian, and therefore land could not be put into trust on their behalf. From there, the case bounced around until finally, last February, a U.S. District Court judge ruled that the Mashpee tribe does satisfy the federal definition of Indian, and the Taunton residents filed the petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that the lower court had wrongly dismissed the case. And that's what kind of brings us to the Supreme Court's dismissal this week.
A lot of the subtext here has to do also with the idea that the tribe could pursue a casino on this land. What is next for it? What do we know about how this decision is going to impact that?
Yeah, I talked to tribal chairman Bryden Whedon about this, and he said the tribe can now continue discussions about what to do with the land, including whether a casino is in the cards. He said we're seeing if there's still that appetite here. And now that this is affirmed, we will be seeing more announcements around this casino question. But he added, importantly, conversations about land use will also be about building a tribal school to educate Mashpee Wampanoag tribe members members on their language, culture, traditions, and more. Because beyond the casino, this win means that they can hold on to this place for future generations. Chairman Whedon said, "We're ensuring people have a place to call home."
It's a big, big moment for the tribe to have this affirmed, that's for sure.
Mm.
Let's switch gears here and talk about another story. This is about North Atlantic right whales. You covered this week. It's kind of like a two-part story. One part good news, the other part bad news. Mm. Let's start with the good.
Yes, let's do that. A 36-year-old right whale mom that researchers call Legato was spotted with her calf in Cape Cod Bay this week. They were the first mother-calf pair of the season to safely reach the bay, which is a big deal because it's a perilous journey from the southeastern calving grounds. I mean, the mom doesn't eat for months, and she travels hundreds of miles all while nursing a calf. And then finally, they get to Cape Cod Bay, where there are these dense, abundant patches of copepods, these little tiny shrimp-like creatures that right whales like to eat. And they're here. You know, researchers from the Center for Coastal Studies have already seen 123 individual right whales in the bay for a population of like 360. So that's about a third of the total population. And locals or, you know, visitors may be able to see some in the coming weeks.
It's exciting that this whale has made it here with her calf. But then the same day that we heard about this happening, we also found out about another right whale that was found dead. Explain what happened there.
Yeah, bad news. Experts found the carcass of a right whale with the number 1950, that's what we're going to call her, on April 2nd. And they did these preliminary findings in a postmortem exam that found catastrophic injuries with complete dislocation of the whale's spine and fractures to all vertebrae in the lower back. Officials say basically a boat would have been responsible for damage at that scale, but they didn't identify any one boat in particular. We can actually hope that there will be some analysis that could reveal something. What makes this worse is that 1950 gave birth just a few months ago, and now her calf has disappeared. Maybe it's died already. Maybe it's adrift somewhere. If it is still alive, it won't survive. You know, this calf was nursing and should have nursed for another 4, 5, 6 months. So we were told, you know, this is a baby without food. It's a horrible story.
This is another story of an endangered right whale dying by ship strike. And again, we're losing a calf kind of in this story, too, it seems like.
Yeah.
How does this keep happening? Tell us what we know about why these whales are still being put in this kind of position.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it has to do with the nature of right whales. Moms and calves are at great risk of vessel strikes, boat collisions, because they spend more time at the water's surface than other whales. They're also all black, so it's actually quite hard for ship captains to see them. You know, and the problems have persisted. Four right whales have died this year, three from vessel strikes, and then another three calves are missing. The only whale to not die of this that we know of so far was the one that died of entanglement and washed up on the vineyard. So to reduce the risk of vessel strikes, officials have proposed modifications to slow boats down. They would make it so that there are more speed rules for boats that are as small as 35 feet instead of just 65 feet and up. They would expand seasonal speed zones in time and space. These rules were published, were published more than 18 months ago, and the final rule is now basically at the White House, but it's been delayed by the Biden administration, which has really angered whale advocates. That said, the delays are in part because the proposed protections have been met with major pushback from ferry operators, those in the shipping industry, and others who rely on fast-moving boats for a living.
And those are the same rules that we were talking about earlier with William Von Herf from the Provincetown Independent.
Yes.
About the impacts they could have on ferries there. A lot of people paying attention to what's happening.
Yeah,
right now.
Touching so much of our lives, our natural world and our, you know, industrialized world.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes. We spoke to Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and of course CAI's Eve Zukoff there. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. The News Roundup is a roller coaster with ups and downs and hairpin turns. Let me tell you, there's no better person to have strapped in the seat beside you for the ride. Thank you, Dan. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.